Hello, this is Pauline Jennings. Welcome to Musician Talk. I am honored to have as my guest today Dr. Timothy Marr, professor of music and conductor of the award-winning St. Olaf Band. He holds a Bachelor of Music degree in composition and a Bachelor of Arts degree in music education from St. Olaf College, and a master's degree in trombone performance and a doctorate of musical arts in instrumental conducting from the University of Iowa. Dr. Marr is an award-winning and internationally acclaimed composer. Recent composition commissions have come from the U.S. Air Force Band, the Music Educators National Conference, and the American Band Masters Association. It's time to hear more about this very accomplished musician. It's time to talk with Dr. Timothy Marr. Welcome, Tim, to the show. I'm so happy to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much.
I think we've tried to do this a couple times, and it hasn't worked with schedules, and so, yes, you're finally here, and it is an honor indeed. So I just want to dig right in to your musical journey. You're a trombone player. Did you start with the trombone? How did you start playing music or listening to music? What's the genesis?
Yeah, I started with piano. My mother, Janine, was a piano teacher, and she had a small studio of kids coming to the house and things like this. And she got me started on piano, and she was smart enough to, put me off to another teacher after a certain point in time because it's hard to get your own kid to do anything.
Right.
And so I started with piano, and then my Uncle Bob had a trombone, a stinky old trombone in an old case, and I ended up getting it when I was in fourth grade. So I started that like a year earlier than most students start on the instrument, and enjoyed the challenge of that. Yeah, as I think back, when I was in the elementary school, I was already working at the junior high a little bit. When I was in the junior high, I was already working at the high school a little bit. And when I was in high school, they had me going over to the UW La Crosse. This is
wow.
La Crosse, Wisconsin. So I always had this chance to be surrounded by people who were better than me, and that helped to push me along.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
Certainly.
Yeah. It's like hitting a tennis ball. If you have a return to you that's hard, you can hit it hard back. If it's just
exactly.
a little thing, you can't, right?
Yep.
That's really cool. So what drew you to the trombone? I mean, you had it there, but what made you keep going with it and go, I like this, I'm going to keep playing it?
I found that the sound was expressive. I could have a good time playing something beautiful and lyrical as an eighth grade trombone player might be able to do. But also the fun of being in a jazz band in particular was a strong motivating device. And that led me to playing baritone bugle in the Blue Stars Drum and Bugle Corps, which was, I marched the last VFW National Championship in 1971 and the first Drum Corps International DCI in 1972. This was when I was in 9th and 10th grade.
Wow.
And that's where I really learned a lot about being focused and driven when you're in rehearsal. The practice sessions were severe.
Wow. In what way?
We were nationally ranked. We almost won the national championship in 1972. We had the top brass line. I was the solo baritone in the top brass line.
Wow, that is really cool.
That it was just sort of a fun aspect of growing up as a musician, but also socially. All my best friends were in the corps. And we traveled the country. It was a fantastic experience all in all.
So did you realize at a pretty young age that you had a gift?
Yeah, I don't know if I recognized it as a gift or anything. Mm-hmm. I had a penchant, or a desire, and I enjoyed doing it. The compositions started in about eighth grade or so when I would try to write piano music to impress young women that I had an interest in. And that really was never very successful.
It did work.
Yeah. But there were all these great horn bands back then, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Chicago,
oh, yes.
And that just infused my love of the instrument. I arranged those pieces for the high school jazz band. You'd get the old 45 and you'd put the needle down and listen for a while, and then you go and lift the needle off and hop to the piano and try to figure out what that was. It was fantastic ear training.
No kidding.
Every once in a while, you can find a piano sketch score for popular music that's out on the radio, and I was able to get a couple of those. But that was the first moments I had of arranging music and setting music and hearing people take the notation from the page and making it come alive. I was writing brass quartets for my buddies in church, and we would play preludes and things like this. And then these arrangements for the high school jazz band. And it was, after a while, it was like, you know, I think I can probably write my own stuff.
Wow.
And that's when I sort of turned the corner and started to create my own music.
So very, very young you started. I mean, I think probably compared to others who start doing this, you were getting that ear training, which is absolutely, I mean, that's huge to have that at such a young age, to be able to listen to something and transcribe it and know what your, it helps with your intervals, it helps, I mean, it just helps with everything.
It does. I wish I would have worked on it even harder than I did, because my ability to sing, my band members will attest to this, I don't really sing all that well, but I can hear it better than I can sing it.
Well, probably two different kind of attributes there. So, So you've played through high school and you had all these great experiences and you were surrounded by these musicians that lifted you up, which is awesome. So what happened from there, like with college? What kind of experiences
did
you have?
Well, you know, the other experiences that lifted me up would be sort of unfortunate ones that happened to my high school band director. One year his wife passed away, the other year he had a heart attack.
Oh, my.
And this was my junior and senior year, and they just sort of looked around in the band room and said, who wants to get on the box and take the band? The choir director would come in and sit in the back and sort of keep the discipline, and I had this chance to conduct the band, the concert group, and that was life-changing. I thought I was going to be a chemistry major. I was pretty well set. I've had great interest in all of that. And then I got bit by this conducting bug.
That's amazing. And
during that senior year, I hopped onto a trip to St. Olaf College that a couple of my friends were taking as a campus visit. I hadn't really heard of St. Olaf College. La Crosse is only 2 hours away, and I didn't really know anything about St. Olaf. And I went along just to, you know, get out of school for the day, that kind of thing. And it was a very fortunate experience, because they were getting ready for the big centennial celebration up on the hill. It was in 1974, you know, the college founded in 1874, and so I had a chance to hear all the groups do something rather remarkable, and it was convincing. This is the place that I should go. I had applied to Northwestern University and Indiana University. I already knew I was going to go into music, and Northwestern didn't accept me, but they invited me back to teach there later on after they figured out I knew what I was doing.
And you showed them.
Well, sort of.
Yeah.
And Indiana accepted me, but so did St. Olaf then, and this seemed to be the place for me.
What comes to mind, the word that comes to mind is serendipity. It just seems like these things were placed in front of you at the right time. You saw them, your eyes were open enough to be able to accept them, and that is really unique. And that itself is a gift, right, to have those things happen in your life.
Very fortunate.
That's great. So what happened in St. Olaf? What did you start to do with bands there?
Well, managed to get over the disappointment I had after auditioning in my first semester there and not making the St. Olaf band. I was in the Norseman band, and I thought, well, I failed. I didn't get in the top group.
Are there many freshmen in the St. Olaf band?
Yeah, there's typically 15 to 20 or so.
Okay.
And it couldn't have worked out better for me. We talked about serendipity. I ended up being the principal trombone of the second group. I got to conduct them and played solos and you know, had leadership responsibility, whereas if I were to have been in the St. Olaf band, I would have been, you know, like fifth chair trombone and sort of not really heard or had any special opportunity. And so it was a strong growth year for me. And then I auditioned and got in for my sophomore year.
And so what were you going there? What degree were you pursuing at the time?
I was a music education. I figured I was going to be a band director. And as the courses started to fall into place, I realized I could also do a theory composition degree if I really hustled. And so I got that at the end of my junior year, and then I got the education degree in my senior year.
I got to believe that you said that for a while you thought maybe you'd get a degree in chemistry, and that the kind of mind that you had that was able to grasp that kind of science and the math that goes along with that really must have helped with the theory and the composition.
Yeah. I there's a strong correlation.
Yeah.
Right now I'm writing a piece and it's called Do the Math.
There you have it.
And it's all about mathematical structures in creating harmonic sets and so on. I'm coming off of my spring sabbatical where I was very fortunate just to have time to write with a clearer mind. You know, it wasn't bogged down with all the busyness of the usual routine. And this is where my brain started going. And I'm really excited about this piece. I'm writing it for Santa Clara, California. Their County Band Director Association has an honor band. I wrote a piece for them about 14 years ago or so, and they asked me to write another one, come back and conduct. And this is a plea from me to all these students to do the math. Take a look at what's going on in the world around you right now and figure out what you can do to make this a better place. It doesn't have to be this way. We can make this a better place.
I love that. I love both sentiments of we could do something about this, but also math. You're speaking to my heart. I think you can explain everything with math, really, when you get down to the basics. Mm-hmm. Everything you hear, everything you see, every pattern, and music is all math. I mean, music is math, and I love that. Yep. I love how analytical you can be, but yet how much beauty there is there. Mm-hmm. Ah. Awesome. We need to move on here. I could talk about this stuff forever, but I want to talk a little bit about your composing.
Sure.
And in particular, what I don't understand how you can compose something for a big group like that. So my experience is you write a song, you bring it to a band, like a combo, and you have the melody line and probably the chord structure, but the drummer makes up their own part. If you have horns, maybe that stuff's written out, but certainly the guitar player makes up their own part, etc. But when you make a piece for a concert band, you're writing everything, and how do you do it?
Well,
how do you keep it all straight in your head?
When people ask what is it like to be a composer, I give them a pretty terse answer. It's make decisions, period. Act, period. You know, you start with a blank slate, literally. I mean, Mahler would say that his symphonies are worlds unto themselves. And, you know, you begin listening to like the first symphony of Mahler, and you realize that by the time you get to the end of it, you've been transported to another place for about an hour.
Yes.
And so it can be very daunting to look at a blank score page and think, well, what am I going to add to the repertoire?
And how do you create a whole world?
Yeah,
right?
You know, but it's a pretty interesting process. Sometimes the commissions come through and there's a very specific reason for a piece to be created. It's in memory of someone, it's celebrating the opening of a new hall or something like this. And those are fun commissions. The best commissions are the ones that say, we just want your next piece.
Nice. Yeah.
And they give you
freedom.
This freedom. Yeah. And I typically need to start with a lot of thinking about, well, why should this piece exist? What is it hopeful of saying? And then eventually a structure starts to be illuminated as to how this might fall together. Unlike many of my colleagues, I don't start in measure one and start writing the piece straight ahead from that point. I improvise at the piano. I record those improvisations, and I listen back to them. I do more ear training on the stuff that really worked well. And I start to gather all sorts of motives and ideas and harmonic progressions and rhythmic patterns and whatnot. And then eventually it sort of becomes a puzzle, and I'm moving the pieces around until I get a sense of what the flow of the structure might be and what it might be able to say. Hardly ever do I start with the very first sound of a piece initially. I usually have to figure out what it is I'm saying with the full thrust of the work, and then I'll figure out how to start it. How can I get the listener ready for what I'm really trying to say as the piece unfolds a little bit more?
That sounds like a kind of existential way to write music a little bit, and also very holistic, not linear, right? It's a feeling, and then, just kind of wrap your head around this idea and then get it down on paper.
Yeah, it's note after note. The software program that I use, Finale software, mm-hmm. They used to have a counter on it, the same as a word counter on a word program. You know, how many words are in my article that I'm writing, or something like that. And in a 5-minute piece for a good high school band, little overture or something like that, there's typically 20,000 to 30,000 markings on a score page. And it counts all the articulation marks, all the notes, everything that is black imprinted on the page gets counted.
Wow.
And so those are all decisions.
Yes, you know? You said, decision period.
Yeah. And then you have to pull out all of the parts. I mean, that's the score. That's the piece of paper where you see every instrument and what they're all playing. Then you have to pull out flute 2 or tenor saxophone or trombone 3, you know. And luckily, the computer does this really well now. I have a big stack, probably 2 feet tall, of manuscripts that I wrote before the mid-90s when the computer software finally kicked in. All of those are in pencil. All of those are in my own hand. And it's a stack like that. And so, you know, you look back on your life's work, and sometimes you sort of shake your head and wonder, how in the world did that ever happen?
Exactly.
You know? And so it's not rocket science. There are things that are a lot more involved than this, but it takes some training. You talk to most of the people who are at my age, and they say, well, I'm finally getting it sort of figured out.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe next year I'll figure this out. You know, I think to somebody like me who cannot do this or couldn't even approach doing it, it is rocket science because it seems to me so complicated in my mind. So that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And so this first piece that we're going to listen to is called Suite for Band. And I was wondering, how long did this piece take? You have different movements have different very feelings.
Yeah, this was a commission from Mason City, Iowa. They were putting up a new auditorium, and it was going to be a community space as well. O.J. Thompson from the Board of Regents at St. Olaf, Thompson Hall up on campus, is named after him.
Okay,
he's the one of the bankers in town, and he got behind and put the funding up for the commission.
Nice.
And it ended up being a 3-movement suite. The first one is called Leaning Forward, and that's about this can-do attitude that everybody had down there to make this new auditorium happen. The middle movement is Lifting Spirits, and Looking Back, and then the last movement is Lifting Spirits. And I tried to write a piece of music that would help them celebrate this event in their community.
That's really great. We're going to listen to the first movement, which is Leaning Forward. And I have to say, I was watching this on YouTube, and I've seen you direct in person. But it just reminded me, and there's not a lot of you on the clip, but I love watching you conduct as well.
Oh.
You're so expressive with your body, particularly your head, and so that's really fun to see too. Coming from an actress, that body
you need
and
to be.
Expression.
It's body language.
Yes, you're telling them what they need to be feeling themselves. So, okay, let's listen to the first movement of Suite for Band, composed by my guest today, Dr. Timothy Marr. This recording is of the 2015 St. Olaf Band performing the piece and conducted by Timothy Marr. This is Pauline Jennings, and you're listening to Musician Talk. You just heard Leaning Forward, the first movement of Suite for Band, conducted and composed by my guest today, Dr. Timothy Marr. This is a recording of the 2015 St. Olaf Band. I love that. And Leaning Forward, we were just talking when we were listening to the song, and that's what it does. It leans forward. And my comment was, you can't lean forward by staying ahead of the beat, because then all of a sudden it gets away from you. It has to all be feel.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, heading forward. And another dramatic. It's very dramatic. And there's that part where there's the low brass, but then you have bells and some high instrument. I'm not sure if it's the flute or what, but the juxtaposition of that is just delightful. Sweeping.
You.
And exciting. Yeah, I love
Thank
it.
You.
And I encourage you guys to go and listen to the full thing, because the next movement is very sweet and tender, and then ends with a bang. So it's a wonderful, wonderful piece. Thank you for that. So I have this quote section of the interview that I like to pull these quotes out to get us thinking about things that maybe I might not think to ask about. I have two today, and the first one is from Michael Tilson Thomas, who's the conductor laureate, amongst other things, of London Symphony Orchestra. And he says, being a conductor is kind of a hybrid profession, because most fundamentally it is being someone who is a coach, a trainer, an editor, and a director. And I'm wondering how that speaks to you and how you mix those things.
Well, I think he got cut off before he got to the end of his sentence, because there's a lot more going on than that even. We talk about this with the people who are learning how to be teachers, how to be band directors and conductors, that the amount of time when you're actually making music by moving your hands through the air is a small portion of your day typically, and the rest of the day is all of the business of teaching, ordering music, getting it out into the folders, writing press releases, getting your posters ready, making sure the auditorium is booked, you know, lining up all the help that you need, moving equipment around. It's a juggling act. And somewhere in the middle of that, you're supposed to find a calm inner place where you can be on a podium and be the music. Because
nice.
That's what you have to do in that moment. Definitely, you know, Tilson Thomas talks about coaching and teaching. That's our primary job. You know, I always view myself more as a teacher than a conductor. It's a little bit different when you might be working with professional adults in a civic ensemble of some sort. But even then, you're teaching.
Right,
because most of the times those people are still learning how to be better, you
right.
know, and it's your job to help them with that. But with the younger students, I'm much more concerned that they're learning the larger lessons of life, of how to get along with each other, how to respect each other, how to set reasonable goals and attain them. You know, the true things that they really need to learn in order to be successful in their lives. We can get at that through music
yes.
rather easily, because it's just a really engaging, fun, rewarding activity.
Well, and compared to other classes on campus in math, science, whatever, there is such a collaborative and cooperative need in with music. And so that is just as teaches you about life, those kind of life lessons.
Yeah, and you know, we're lucky. Coaches, theater directors, and so on, we get to work with students through the entire 4-year cycle of high school or college.
Yes.
We don't have them popping into a bio class for a semester and then we don't see them again. You know, we establish a very different connection with the student. I really appreciate the fact that when the students come to St. Olaf College, they're 3 months older than a high school senior. And
right.
what have they been doing that summer? You know, and, you know. So you're getting them at that point. And then at the end of 4 years where you've been able to make music with them, in my case, while you're teaching them for 4 years, now they're 22-year-old adults, and they've got a career focus, and they've just matured. And this has been the age group that I've found resonates with me the strongest as a teacher. I've really enjoyed that transition for a person.
Yeah.
18 to 22.
That's got to be so rewarding to see that happen, mm-hmm. particularly when you're with them all 4 years and you have that trust built up. And that's another thing that you could really learn in music and in theater. I think in art in general, you have to take risks, public risks,
yes.
Out loud risks that everybody's there to witness. So you have
that's
to have that trust.
Out loud risks. I like that.
Yeah. And so you have to have that trust amongst your fellow students and players and with your teacher, certainly, and your mm-hmm. professor. So that's a great, great place to learn some of those life lessons. Do you feel that throughout your career as a professor, your emphasis and focus has changed? I mean, what have you learned, I guess, about being a better teacher?
Oh, what a fun thing to think about. I've learned that I need to back off and let them discover more.
Mm.
When I first started teaching, I think I was under the advice maybe that I got in the wrong way. I don't know how I started thinking about this, but it was like I'm the one who's supposed to tell them everything that they're supposed to know.
Sure,
you know,
why not?
I'm the teacher.
Right.
And that has shifted over time, that I'm there to facilitate and to motivate them to go on self-discovery missions and things along these lines.
That sounds to me kind of like parenting, and the difference between parenting and grandparenting. Mm-hmm. I'm not a grandparent, but I've witnessed it and how much more laid back and how much more space you give a child when you're a grandparent than particularly your first child, between your first child and your second child. That's awesome. My second quote is Arturo Toscanini, and I just wanted to touch on this because I think it's fascinating and how you make decisions as a writer and who you're trying to please and who's your audience. And he said, if you want to please the critics, don't play too loud, too soft, too fast, or too slow. Which I love that.
Milk
right?
toast. You know?
Right?
Yeah, it's just probably sage advice.
Doesn't get you great music, though.
No, I don't think so.
Right.
I think ultimately, as a composer, you're writing to please yourself.
Okay.
You know, you've set standards and hopes and so on, and are you meeting them? Does it feel like it's honest work? Does it have as much integrity as you can put into it, and so on? It took until my 30s before I finally, pardon me, started writing music that I felt was my own. Up until that point, I think I was writing music that people expected me to write.
Yeah.
Completing assignments, getting noticed in the praise of teachers and all that bit as you're growing up. And it was in the early 30s, I wrote a piece called The Soaring Hawk, which won a national prize. And that was this moment where I realized that work had more of me in it than me trying to be somebody else as mm-hmm. a composer, and it was accepted, and it was just a shot in the arm. And so now I took off in a sort of a new direction with what I was creating.
And you get to do that for your students too, teach them and give them the feedback that they need to be able to speak from their own heart when they write.
Yeah, you know, teaching composition is really an interesting thing. Dwayne Wee in town here.
I love him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, I sat with him before I was even a prof here. I was working a summer camp here. I used to teach up at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And we were having lunch together, and he said, "How do you teach composition?" And we just had this wonderful talk about that. And he said, "How do you know, if you don't understand the music that this young person is bringing, and how do you know they're not the next Mozart and you just don't get it?"
Right. Oh,
and
that's
I, and
a
I
great
thought,
question.
Oh, Dwayne.
Yeah.
It was just so much fun to think about that. And so in my composition class and lessons, private lessons with the young composers, it's more of a looking at the material that they're bringing in and helping them see the potential to do something different with it. Have you thought about doing this here?
Right.
You're setting me up to expect this right now, but you're not giving it to me yet. What are you going to give me? This feels really great right here. Why are you leaving it so soon? Can't we stay here longer?
Nice.
You know,
yes.
And these are the questions that just sort of, it's not, it pushes them. I'm not trying to tell them that they need to have a G major chord there or that this should be a B flat.
Right. You're
boring.
Just suggesting what to think about.
Yeah, they'll get it figured out.
Right.
Yep.
That's wonderful. I think about, it seems like to be a composition teacher, you almost have to have a lot of experience in composing things yourself, and really in order to help somebody else. We're teaching other things, you know, you might know theory, and you learned it when you went to university to be a teacher, you could teach that. But composition, it feels like you just have to have a lot of experience to be good at teaching.
Yeah, I tried to share with them the problems and concerns and hassles that I'm having in my own writing. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to run into this problem until I started doing something else, for example. You know, that kind of advice pops in every once in a while as well. Awesome. All these students are smarter than I am.
That's a great attitude to have. I doubt it, but it's a great.
Oh, they are. They are brilliant young men and women, you know, and it's get out of their way, you know.
I love that. Yep. I love that. It's just, you're more of a mentor than a teacher, mm-hmm. right? Maybe, perhaps you'd say. Well, let's turn to the second piece here, Fantasia in G, that you wrote this as well. Oh, this is such a fun song. It's so much fun to listen to. But why don't you tell me the inception or the kind of story behind writing this song?
Well, this one started as a piece for pipe organ or organ. It wasn't a pipe organ. It was an electric device in our Faith Lutheran church down in La Crosse, Wisconsin. My brother got married, and he wanted some music to get him out of the church. You know, and so this was written for my brother Todd and his wife Deb, and they recessed with this piece. And then my predecessor here, Miles Johnson, invited me to take the band during the interim of January 1983, while I was still doing my master's work down at the University of Iowa. And I thought, well, this is the chance. I'm going to score this out for band. Percy Grainger, a great composer, used to write band music on the pipe organ, because when you press the key down, it keeps coming. If you do it on the piano, it dies away instantly.
Right.
The pipe organ, it would sustain. And I had heard that, and I thought, you know, this has always sort of been a band piece in my head. So I scored it out, and we premiered it up in Bow Chapel in January of 1983. And I shared the concert with Joanne Polly. She was the other conductor at the time. And that was the taste I really got to have of, you know, working with the St. Olaf Band. Mighty Johnson let me conduct my senior year.
Wow, that's
on
great.
Tour as well. I did the Waltz of the Flowers and the All Tchaikovsky second half. And these are the kinds of opportunities that he created for me, and my high school band director created for me as well. Why don't you arrange this? Why don't you write the drill for the marching band show? You know, all of these opportunities meant the world to me in my own development, and that's one of the things I've been trying to do as a teacher myself, is to spread it around, make sure we have a lot of fun that way.
I got to believe that part of that is just your musicianship. It's also your personality, that you probably are very, very fun to work with, and I've heard that about you anyway.
Well,
so,
I like to have a good time.
That's good. That's really good. Just briefly, I want to take a sidebar here to ask about your getting hired at St. Olaf and how that, I mean, you had these opportunities to show what you could do while you were still a student there.
Yep.
How many years was it before you came back and as a professor
yourself? I had 3 years of high school teaching, 2 years of grad work, and 10 years at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And so I came down here, I think I was 37 years old or something like that. And I didn't apply right away when it was open, because I knew they needed to find the right person, and I didn't think that was me.
Oh, see, you're humble too.
Well, I don't mean to do this, I guess. But, you know, it took me a while to finally get brave enough to even put my papers in, and then it worked out. And I'm really glad it did. It's just been an incredible place to grow and to make music together and to raise a family in Northfield here.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Well, they've been very lucky to have you. I think that everybody that knows you feels that way. So let's see. We'll move on to Fantasia and G. This is Dr. Timothy Marr is live in the KYMN studio with me today, and it's time to listen to Fantasia and G, a piece he wrote and conducted in Japan with the Senjoku Gakuin College of Music Freshman Wind Ensemble.
Yes.
Awesome. This is Musician Talk, and I'm your host, Pauline Jennings. My guest today is Dr. Timothy Marr. We just played his original piece called Fantasia in G. This recording is of Dr. Marr conducting the, Senjoku Gakuin College of Music Freshman Wind Ensemble. So tell me about that experience, working with that group and going over to Japan and all that.
Yes, I was very fortunate to be asked to go spend a week at this institution 2 years in a row. And
I can't hear myself.
Yeah, we're not getting it through our headphones here.
Okay. So go ahead.
Very good. And it's the Sensoku Gakuin College of Music is similar to Curtis or Juilliard or Eastman in our country here, one of the major conservatories. And this is just the collection of serious musicians that are at the freshman level.
Wow.
You know, and but they're so thoroughly prepared. They take music making over there very seriously. The concert band movement in particular is quite strong. The St. Olaf Band was there back in 2010 on our study tour. We had Mac Gimsey and Pat Quaid as people who came along with us and helped us through understanding what Japan is all about culturally. And at each performance, we had people lined up outside for an hour ahead of time waiting to get in. Uh-huh. Everything was standing room only. Students were getting requests for autographs and so on. They really love concert band music and take it super seriously over there. And so I go over there to guest conduct, and they've already prepared the program, and it's like note perfect. I just add nuances and help shape it a little bit and have fun trying to speak a little bit of Japanese, which is very minimal, and having an interpreter help me in the rehearsal process. And it's just going to be a great trip once again. We're going to go there at the end of this academic year.
Oh, how
fabulous. It's my final year, and we were supposed to tour last year on our normal rotation, but the pandemic sort of threw a wrench into those plans, and we're hopeful of going over this year now and re-experiencing some of that joy that we had back in the 2010 tour.
Oh, delightful. So how long do you go for? And what do you do while you're there? I mean, do you have a lot of concerts?
Yeah,
is it something every day?
It's not like a domestic tour. When we go to California for our domestic tour this year, and it's a concert every day, and that's typical. When we go on the international tours, we understand that there's more to the learning when you're abroad than normal. And so I think we have 5 or 6 concerts over the course of about 14 days.
Oh, how lovely. So the students get a chance to go out and experience the culture.
We've had some wonderful experiences like that with a study tour to Japan, to Australia, New Zealand, and also to Mexico, where the interim class was a class taken by everybody in the band, which hardly ever happens at St. Olaf, where you have first-year students and seniors in the same class.
Sure.
And 90 people in the class.
Well.
You know? I mean, this is this odd thing. And a couple of professors would go along and help teach the class, and then we have 2 weeks on campus, in January with a morning and afternoon rehearsal and a morning and afternoon class. And we do that for 2 weeks. We hop on a plane. We land in the country we're going to, and everything that we've been studying comes live in front of our eyes.
Oh, that is just
the concerts
so
are
wonderful.
Like sort of secondary,
sure.
You know, and yet they're fantastic. We're ready to go, and we're playing in good halls, and it's just a learning experience that changes lives.
No kidding. No kidding. My semester abroad at the U of M was nothing like that. It was more about just partying, I guess, or something like that. But that sounds like such great experiences for those students, and mm-hmm. to have that time to prepare for that. Yeah. That sounds wonderful. So, Tim, we've gotten to the portion of my show called Best Gig, Worst Gig. So what do you got for us?
Well, the best gig... It's hard to beat walking on stage at Carnegie Hall.
Oh,
I'll just say that. You know, it was a dream when I took over the position here to see if I could get the band to Carnegie Hall. And we were able to do that for the 125th anniversary of the band back in 2016. And to just know that that was happening in my life, let alone for all the students on stage and everything, it was surreal and it was relaxed and comfortable.
Nice.
Yeah, we all sort of, when we first walked in there and you get your dress rehearsal and you look around and it's like, oh my God, what's going on here?
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then you settle down because you got to get to work.
Right.
You know, and that takes over. And the audience was over 1,000 people and they all seemed to be there because they really liked the St. Olaf band, you know?
Oh, neat.
And we just had a nice, warm, beautiful concert. It worked really well. We premiered a piece by David Maslanka, who is one of the major composers for wind band, and he wrote a piece entitled Angel of Mercy for us. And to be able to, you know, premiere a work, Martin Hodel, our trumpet professor, soloed on a piece with us. We just had a great concert. And I just remember walking out on that stage thinking, it's not really going to ever get any better than this. You know?
Wow.
But it does, because we've had fantastic concert experiences in little towns in Montana, for example, on tour, where they give you the key to the city, you know, because we're the biggest live thing they've had there in the last 25 years, you know, and that's just fun, too, and musically rewarding, because when you're in the middle of the piece, that's what's taking over your entire life at that moment.
Right.
The audience is on that journey with you, and you're as focused and alive as you possibly can be.
Right, so it's like before and after you realize you're at Carnegie Hall, but when you're playing the music, it doesn't matter where you are.
Yeah.
Because you're in that moment.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
The other best one that comes to mind, I wrote a work entitled Imagining Peace, and it was for the Minnesota Symphonic Winds. This is the adult group that I conduct up in the Twin Cities. And it was for a Peace and Justice Forum concert that was at Central Lutheran Church. And I found quotes from all cultures, all time periods that dealt with peace, justice, freedom, put it together in a format. It's about a 15-minute piece for narrators and band, and had a great experience premiering it there. We took it on a tour with the St. Olaf Band out to California back in 2020, and it's the piece where I feel maybe this is why I'm on the earth.
Wow.
You know,
that's
because it's, I think, an effective way of sharing really important words from brilliant people talking about how we can be better.
Where could I find this to listen to?
You can find it on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah, and Imagining Peace.
Imagining Peace. Mm-hmm. Oh, I want to hear that. That sounds absolutely lovely. Wow. So, worst gig?
Well, yeah, you know, I tripped and broke my thumb about a week before going on tour back in 2007, and it was my left hand, fortunately. I hold the baton with my right hand, and they put a cast on. It was a stupid home accident. I tripped over something, and I think I broke a bone, you know?
It takes a second.
That kind of thing. And the first cast that was put on me, I couldn't pinch my index finger and my thumb together to pick up a page and turn the page of a score.
Oh, no.
And I thought, I got to memorize my entire program in a week.
Gosh.
So I went back to the doctor and I said, I need to be able to do this. And they said, well, you might not heal as well. And I don't care. I got to turn the score pages, you know.
I got a concert. I got a gig.
And I had to make it black.
Nice.
So it would stick out from my tuxedo coat and it would just look like one arm was longer than the other. But what I didn't anticipate was trying to get my shirt on, dressing out for the first concert, and I couldn't get the cast through the shirt without just like jamming it through the sleeve. Just all sorts of crazy stuff like that with that concert.
Oh,
I had another
funny
tour where I needed to have a root canal right in the middle of tour. Yeah, it was out in Washington State, Oregon, that northwest area, and going up in the flight and coming back down, the change in pressure just sort of finally popped the tooth or whatever right. happened, you know. And the first couple of performances were excruciating. I couldn't concentrate.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's hard to be in the
and
moment.
And finally, they called a dentist in, like, Eugene, Oregon or something like this. And I went in early morning before the band had to leave. And I had a... they checked and they said, yeah, you need a root canal. And so they called Salem, Oregon, and they got me an appointment. The band went and set up and rehearsed on their own.
Oh,
and I
goodness.
Sat and had a root canal. And then I had such it's a memorable performance for me because there was no pain anymore.
Right.
And I was just so free.
Yeah.
Plus, they probably gave me some medication. I don't remember, you know. But it was
that too.
It was just a delight to not have that pain happening anymore. So,
oh, isn't that the truth? When you live with pain, and then you get away from that pain, it's like, oh, I see. Now I remember.
Yeah.
Now I remember how it feels to feel normal. Well, damn it, this has just been a delightful and wonderful conversation, and I've learned a lot about you and had some laughs and got some great insights. So I just want to thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
For coming. And you have this tour over in Japan coming up. When is your spring concert? Is that no, we have winter here first. I'd like to ignore that fact. But.
Actually, we're still in September.
wait, fall first.
Yeah.
And so, I just want to go to next summer. That's all I
want. We have a concert on Saturday night.
Oh.
On October 1st.
I should have known that.
In the
I'm
evening
sorry.
Up on campus, and it's sort of the family weekend homecoming concert.
Right.
I have six former students who are now out teaching coming back to guest conduct.
Oh.
They're all doing one movement of a six-movement divertimento. They're all going to sit up on stage and hop up one at a time on the box, and we'll have to choreograph this thing, but... And then I have another former student coming back to solo. And so,
oh, that's wonderful.
Well, it's my last homecoming concert. And so
exactly.
I wanted to, for the six conductors, I wanted them to have a chance to get up in front of that band. I've had a whole bunch of former students have that opportunity. It's like you have the keys to a really great car and you say, here, take it around the block, you know?
Yes.
And they get to, you know, be with the St. Olaf band. It's just... fun to watch them doing that.
And you're providing the opportunities that were once afforded you, which is just mm-hmm. really great. And so that's October 1st at?
Yep. 8 p.m., I believe, is
8 p.m.
in Skoglund.
At Skoglund, mm-hmm. Okay. That's what I wanted to know, so I'm hoping I can make that one. I would love to
The other big one that I'd love to plug on the radio right
Please
now
do.
Is May 5th. Next spring, and it's up at Orchestra Hall, and it's the big final concert of my career. They did one last year for Steven Amundsen with the St. Olaf Orchestra.
That's right.
And they're doing it again for me. And it's on Cinco de Mayo, and so we had a tour to Mexico and picked up some repertoire down there that we used after the fact when we returned home here. Moncayo is the composer. Huapango is the title of the piece, and
wonderful.
So I'm going to do a Mexican piece right on Cinco de Mayo as part of the program, and all of our programming of late with many ensembles all around the nation, it has such a stronger push to support and amplify the voices of composers who just haven't gotten a chance yet.
Exactly, that's great.
BIPOC composers, female composers, and so on. And so it'll be all of my programming now has that in mind in an intentional way. A couple of years ago, we did a program that was six women composers, and I didn't plug it as anything other than the spring concert.
As it should be.
Exactly.
As it should be. However,
exactly.
I have to say, and I'm just going to go ahead and do a plug too,
sure.
because I've directed a show that we have our last performance today at 2:00, and it's all divas, so it's all women, and we make a big deal out of that. Because it's not only 10 women, it's really some of the strongest singers in the area, and it's really a great show. Audiences have loved it. So, okay, I'm done with that plug. So thank you so much for being on. I've loved this. It's been a great conversation, and great to get to know you a little better. So
likewise.
Take care.
Thank you.
Many, many thanks to Dr. Marr for joining me today to share his journey with us and to give us some insight into his music. Thanks also to Wendy Nordquist, and so many thanks to you, the listeners of Musician Talk on the One, KYMN. Have a joyous day.